What happened, man? You changed, Ben Franklin. You changed.
This is Up Up Down Down, the only video game podcast with exactly four directions in the name. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, and is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us is Patrick Gibson, a veteran of Apple and Tilde. Patrick is now a developer at Pacific Helm.
Hey.
There he built the world's only app for exclusively tracking what rides you've been on at Disneyland. Hi, Patrick.
Hey. I'm so excited. I jumped the gun.
I know. It's excellent. And people can know who is who by our voices. It's the miracle of technology. So our topic today, or at least our initial topic, is game length. As adults, as people who, you know, are playing games, you know, we've been in love to some degree with video games for a decade or decades. Now we've grown up. We don't necessarily have the time to play the 100, 200 hour RPGs that maybe we loved as kids. And we're going to talk today about game length and the trade-offs in between sort of getting bang for your buck, actually finishing games, whether or not we even do that anymore. And the thoughts around game design that come into play when you're a grown-up. So I think to start things off, the thing that makes me feel strongly about this and really put this in the front of my mind was when I played Portal and Journey, which are games maybe in the last, Portal's maybe 5 years old, Journey's newer, but games that are these experiences that are short, maybe 5 hours or less, but are so sweet that you just think, if every moment of playing a game was like this, then everyone would be a convert. You know, all those people out there who are maybe critical of, oh, I'm not going to spend my time playing video games, I don't have time for that, I'm just going to watch a movie. If they played an experience or had an experience like I had with Portal or Journey, they would feel a lot differently than just grinding through, 100 hours of some RPG or something like that. And so that's the thing that makes me feel strongly about this. And I tend to start things by turning to Nigel as the sort of game industry expert, you know, of the three of us. It's like, why isn't every game like Journey or Portal? Why aren't they all just like 5 hour experiences where at the end of it, you literally like you tear up because of how touching it was, as opposed to these 100 hour side quest-a-thons?
Well, for the same reason that like Walmart moves a lot more Harlequin romance novels than it does like literary fiction, because the market doesn't entirely demand that. Games like that are still outliers in terms of how many people connect to them in that way. Portal maybe is much more mainstream than something like Journey. Like Journey's a game that you know, the people that have played it for the most part love it, but a lot of people haven't played it and it doesn't sound very interesting to them, and that's kind of their loss. But and you know, even some of the games that have that have success, that have a lot of length, like if you look at where that length comes from, it's in multiplayer content and stuff that you can just sort of grind over and over again, right? Like the Call of Duties of the world, like they have like main campaigns that aren't really much longer than something like Portal, but that's not why the majority of people are buying them. Like I personally buy the Call of Duty games for the single player missions, but most people don't. Most people are playing the multiplayer, and multiplayer, and you can sink dozens, if not hundreds of hours into, and that's what most people are looking for from that, it seems like.
So we have this trade-off of multiplayer versus single player, which I think is a sort of a big part of this game length. Like, how long is a multiplayer game? It's effectively infinitely long. It's as long as you're willing to invest. Whereas a single player game obviously takes money. I mean, a AAA game now costs as much as producing a blockbuster film. And the longer it is, the more expensive it's going to be if it's actually quality content and not just sort of grindy stuff. So obviously that's part of the trade-off. But I think we have to take into account if you're thinking from the perspective of someone who's publishing games and designing games, is that a lot of the people who, yeah, you know, kids who have infinite amount of time, and, you know, maybe they get one game at Christmas and they have to make it stretch all year. So they complain on the forums that the game isn't long enough. Yeah, like they have a lot of time and they might be noisy, but how many games are they buying per year? Whereas people like ourselves, you know, I don't know about you, but I probably buy 10 games a year and then have the time to finish like one of them. Right. So there's definitely a disbalance as opposed to people who have time but no money versus money but no time. And, you know, not to say I want to deprive the children their giant epic games, but I think it's not just a numbers game as far as who's interested in what.
I think there's also a certain like risk reward thing there with making a game short. Is in order for a short game to be successful, it's got to be really good, and it's got to be the central gameplay mechanic and the story have got to be something that appeals to everyone, whereas a larger, longer game has got a bit more room to be a bit flabbier and still work, because you can have variety, right? Like the open world games are like the key example of that, where almost all open world games have a huge number of side missions and extra content and stuff like that, that basically you don't have to have anything to do with unless you like it. And, you know, a lot of the strategy is like drop as much of that stuff in as you can. That stuff's easier to parallelize than a very tight story driven adventure in terms of how you create it. And people will find the stuff that they like and do the side missions that they like and ignore the side missions that they don't like. And so if you make a game that's, you know, 50 hours to do everything, then hopefully each person will find a 10 to 20 hour game that they like, even if it's not the same 10 to 20 hours for everyone.
Yeah. It's interesting. It kind of seems to me that Portal and Journey kind of hit this sweet spot in the market where, if you look at the market of games as a spectrum, where on one end you have these massive, you know, Call of Duty type and Call of Duty and Mass Effect and obviously World of Warcraft MMOs in general, these huge sort of open-ended multi-hour games. And then the other end of the spectrum, you have, you know, iPhone games and shorter, lower budget, faster games. Portal and Journey kind of hit that sweet spot where they're in between, where they're not taking too much time, but they still require a bit of investment, but that investment just pays off so much more, or as much as the longer, bigger games in a smaller amount of time, right?
Yeah, well, there's an interesting thing that happens in these long games, where, like you mentioned, Mass Effect, which is a sort of sci-fi RPG that lasts, I don't know, 50 hours or something. It's a fairly long game because it's one of these RPGs. And that after that amount of time, of course, you're going to at least have some emotional connection because you spend a crap load of time with these characters or with this world. Whereas Journey, you know, it's some investment, but it's a pretty short, like Journey is not much longer than a film. And after 3 hours, like I really cared about this little guy that had no, like,
no face, no name, no nothing.
Yeah, yeah. He couldn't even talk. He couldn't do anything. He can make little meeps and moops and like, not even that. He just like, he can make a little sphere or glow out of him. And that's about how he communicate with the world. And I still was touched by this in the amount of time where you play an RPG like 100 hours later. Yeah. I mean, I kind of care, but it's sort of brute force at that point.
Nigel, maybe you know, since you're more of an industry veteran, but is it just that there wasn't really a place for these games before, where because the economics of it not work out, where you just couldn't make a 5 hour game? Like you had to either go all in or do like a snake type, you know, web or iPhone game?
I think there was definitely some of that in sort of the previous couple of rounds of console games. Like it's really only with the 360 and the PS3 that like downloadable content became a thing at all. And I think without that, you can't do a console game in that niche as effectively. Even Portal, which was like sold on disc, it wasn't sold by itself on disc. Like the only way to get Portal on,
yeah, it was part of the Orange Box or,
yeah, so you're getting like Half-Life 2 and Team Fortress 2 and I think Half-Life 2 episode 1, maybe.
Actually, it was when I bought the Orange Box, I believe it was Half-Life 2 and episode 1 and 2 and, yeah, Team Fortress and Portal. Like Portal was why I bought it, because everyone's like, oh my god, you gotta, yeah, play Portal. I'm like, I guess same. I'll play the best, or at least the best acclaimed first person shooter of his generation as well. But well, yeah, it all came as one.
Action. I mean, Half-Life 2, I think, is an interesting counterpoint to Link because it's a game that I really strongly feel like with both the Half-Lives, actually, that they'd be better games if they were a couple hours shorter. Like they were games that were flabby and were flabby, not in the way that open world games are, where there's side content that you can ignore. With both Half-Life and Half-Life 2, there's things that you have to get through because it's a story driven experience. And like I've played through Half-Life 2, I think twice. Like I played through it once when I originally got it on the PC, and then I played through it again when I got the orange box before playing episode 1 and 2, because I hadn't played them before that. And like, I just found myself all the time in Half-Life 2 just being like, where am I? What am I doing? What's going on? Why? Like, why am I going through this thing? Like, I lost track of what was going on all the time because there's just, it's such a long game compared to most first person shooters. I would have been totally happy with them taking like several hours off of it.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I haven't actually played Half-Life 1. I played Half-Life 2, but the famous thing you say, and I've heard other people say, that Half-Life 1 is a good game and then like a few hours of extra stuff at the end.
Yeah, Half-Life 1 is three quarters of Half-Life 1 is one of the best games ever made.
Yeah. And then they're like, well, I guess we should have some finale with aliens in outer space or something like that. And
I'm sure it will all be resolved in Half-Life episode 3.
Yeah, in like 2029, yes, when they eventually get to that. But yeah, I totally, like myself, I agree. Like I, almost every game I play could be shorter. I can't think off the top of my head, like maybe I guess the first Portal, but even the first, like Portal 1 is maybe 4 or 5 hours, but everyone said it was so short. By the end of it, I was like, okay, I thought this was short and it's still going. Like I didn't feel like at the end that I was cheated out of anything, that it was too short. Whereas there's plenty of games where, like, so I just finished the Saints Row the Fourth or whatever it is, and they literally joke in the game that they're padding the game with extra missions just to, like, someone's like, oh, like, we got to kill more Zin. It's like, why? Well, we got to pad the game out a little more. Like, and it's just, and then you just kill, like, when I say trash, does that mean, is that like a common term? You guys know it's an MMO term. But it's basically this idea. It comes from, I think, Ultima Online, where there was this one level that you had to do where you had to invade a house and the front yard, there's a bunch of trash and you had to literally fight the trash. And every time you did it, it was just like you had to kill the trash before you could get to the boss that had the loot that you really wanted. And you're doing this over and over again. And it became a synonym for killing enemies that you've killed before and they're not really challenging and you don't really care, but you're just killing them, and it's really good synonym because trash is just like, it's garbage. Like, yeah, okay, killing another pig. Yeah,
I've always heard this. I've heard this described as grinding.
Yeah, grinding. And like grinding as the whole is anything you're doing repeatedly in order to make numbers get bigger. Yeah. And trash is very specifically the enemies you kill in order to either make numbers get bigger or to gain access to something that is on the other side. And that's something I don't feel like as much in Nigel actually convinced me to play the Modern Warfare games after a lot of stubbornness and I was refusing to play, but in some of the other, especially maybe PS2 era first person shooters or Half-Life 2, that you're like, more of these guys that I know I can definitely kill. Yeah, more of them. Yeah, I've seen this guy before. They didn't design a new enemy or doesn't even look any different. It's just you're killing more.
I actually never made it to the World of Warcraft endgame stuff because of all the quests that I was doing just felt so repetitive and so much, there was so much trash. I got to like level, I got to the point where I got an epic mount and then I was like, all right, so I'm done. I've had enough. I have an epic mount. That's it.
Right. But you need to collect 34 more Borskin.
Oh yeah.
Because the city really desperately needs 34 worst. More Borskins from you specifically. And there's like 100 other people next right by you who are also collecting 35 Borskins.
And that's a trap that's easy for the MMOs to fall into because they can't really give you shortcuts without just kind of everything getting really cheeseball and pointless. Like at least in games where you've got some of that collecting going on that are single player experiences, there's ways you can often get around them. Like I just finished Assassin's Creed 4 a while back and it's got some of that grindiness with collecting enough of the like hunting goods to build all of the extra equipment that you want, but you can kind of just give up at any point and start buying the stuff, right? When you're like, all right, I've gone to enough islands and killed enough iguanas and hunted down enough whales, like, yeah, that stuff's okay, but I'm getting sick of it now. You can just like go to the store and spend money to buy enough trade goods to build the rest of the stuff and not have to worry about it, which is an out that you just can't give someone in an MMO, right?
Like, well, otherwise the game's over. You collected everything.
Yeah.
And maybe Patrick, you might have an opinion on this, but I've grown to feel, after being a recovering World of Warcraft addict and RPG addict, that anytime a game makes me collect any number of anything higher than one, I'm immediately like this is bullshit.
No, I'm still okay. I don't know. So I recently finished, for the second time, Tomb Raider. Did you guys play Tomb Raider, the new one?
I did.
I actually just finished it for the first time, like, two nights ago.
So there were a lot of side quests in that, like, you know, lighting all the flames in the village and things like that, where it was more than one, but I didn't feel, because they were fun to find, I didn't feel like it was a drag. I didn't feel like it was trash. So I think that it can be implemented well, but when it's just like, kill this thing and hope that it drops the thing that you're looking for, the boar tusk or whatever, that sucks.
Tomb Raider, the problem that I had with the side quests was not that they were necessarily bad, but I felt like I was like violating the fiction of the world to do them. Because it was always like, oh my god, this airplane just crashed and like the pilot's stranded on this mountainside and you gotta get to him before the bad guys do, and oh, by the way, do you want to run around lighting these like four fires,
yeah,
and then go and do this side temple puzzle quest to get like a new part for your bow before you go and save that guy's life? Like,
but hurry.
it felt a little ridiculous.
Totally. So I only did I did all of them the second time through because that was just more fun. Because I knew it was gonna happen, but definitely the first time I was playing it, because the game was so, it's a fantastic game, by the way, if you're listening and you haven't played it. But the game is such a cinematic experience that you're absolutely right. It's hard to take yourself out of that and be like, hold on, let me go find these little fireflies.
So I skipped a lot of those like collecting stuff side missions. I did all of the like temples that you had to do, or I guess the actual tombs, because one, you usually got something nice at the end of that, and I quite liked the puzzles in those. Like, I did the first one, I'm like, yeah, this is like a fun little puzzle thing. You know, a lot more like the first couple Tomb Raiders, like back in the day, you know, where most of it was puzzle and there was very little shooting people. So I'm like, okay, yeah, this is nice. I should do all these. But all the collection side quests, even the ones that, you know, were sort of fun to hunt everything down, like, I didn't get that feeling that like I should be doing it. I felt like, no, I should be going and continuing the story because they're trying to set up this momentum and this peril and stuff like that, and I'm not respecting that if I'm running around doing all these errands.
Bringing it back to game length, I thought that it was the perfect for the scope of the game, for like how beautiful it was and how obvious it was they spent so much time on all those textures and the island itself, and just the art direction in it was so amazing. I just wanted to keep looking at it, and so for the length that it was, which was for me about 15 hours, it ended up, I thought it was like perfect. It wasn't too long, it wasn't too short. I was able to, if you like come home from work and play it for like an hour a day every day, you can get done in 2 weeks easy. So I thought it was a perfect length for the scope of it.
Yeah, I thought it was actually really good in terms of length. Like, it definitely felt like it didn't overstay its welcome. It was very nicely balanced. There's enough variety and stuff. Mm-hmm. I definitely agree. Like, it seemed like about the perfect length to me.
And some of that has to do with not actually the total length that it takes to beat the game, but also how low are the lows, right? Like, some games have this very even pace where the whole time, like something like Dishonored or The Last of Us, where the whole time you feel motivated to keep moving along. Whereas my particular of this generation, what I find is one of the more overrated games is Assassin's Creed 3. Which,
oh, I totally agree.
It's controversial because some people really loved it, and I think Nigel quite liked it.
I enjoyed Assassin's Creed 3, but I agree with a lot of the criticisms of it. Like, I enjoyed it because it was still what I like about the rest of the Assassin's Creed games, which I do really like, and the downsides didn't bother me enough. But I'm not gonna claim that the criticisms that people are making of it are not true.
Yeah, and part of it is partially the fault of, because like you say, there's a lot of these side missions that you kind of have to know whether or not you are going to enjoy. Like I was in Assassin's Creed 3 and I was going along. I got through that part at the beginning where you're sort of like, hello, let me like wear the assassin's cloak and be awesome. And it's sort of making you trudge through all this stuff. And I get to Boston, which is the sort of the first main city you end up in. And I meet Ben Franklin and I'm like, oh my God, it's Ben Franklin. This is awesome. And of course it's the trope that you meet famous people immediately as soon as you walk into the city. But the first thing he said to me was, oh, there are some pages of my book scattered around Boston. Please help me find them. And I'm like, fuck off, Ben Franklin. Like, I don't care about you anymore because you're asking me to go fetch things like within 4 seconds of meeting you. And I know what you are. You're the guy in the game that tells me to fetch things. And then I guess I get more.
You gold. Used to be cool, Ben Franklin, until you asked me to do something.
What happened, man? You changed, Ben Franklin. You changed.
Exactly. And that's
some of that's just framing, though. Like the catching the pages gameplay, I actually don't mind for the most part. And I found it way less frustrating in Assassin's Creed 4 than Assassin's Creed 3, because the payoff in Assassin's Creed 4 was way better, which is that every time you caught one of the pages, your crew on your boat learned a new sea shanty.
Nice.
So just that framing device change took those from something that I'm like, yeah, I sort of enjoy doing those, but I don't really care enough to do it, to like, I think I probably got 80 or 90% of them when I was playing through Assassin's Creed 4.
Because you wanted the sea shanty.
Because I'm like, yeah, these sea shanties are, like, awesome. Like, they're great.
And it's a subtle change that makes all the difference. So that idea of completionism, I think, is an interesting thing where, all of us are programmers by trade, where our brains are wired sort of mathematically, and I think a lot of people who are technical want those numbers to go up. We want to fill in if there are those side missions or things you can collect or whatever. Unless we've learned by trial and error that it's a bad path to go down, we like to fill all of those bars. And I think it's maybe controversial that if games give you those options, yes, you don't have to follow them. There's a lot of people who will follow them regardless and then just resent it. Is that a valid criticism of a game, or is it just kind of user error?
I kind of think it's user error, to be honest. Like, I think that's something that you kind of got to learn about yourself, is like which of those things you're deriving pleasure from and not do the ones that are annoying you. Like I said, I mean, when you're making one of these big open world games, you've kind of got to say like, all right, let's make like 6 different 20-hour games that 6 different types of people can enjoy playing. And, you know, people should have that variety and be able to pick the stuff that they want and don't want. And, like, it seems that something like Assassin's Creed would not be well served by them saying, okay, we're just going to, like, boil it all down and take away all that side content because some people are sinking too much time into it and not enjoying it. Like, people should have a little bit of discipline to find the stuff that they like and follow up on it. And it's a skill you got to learn. Like, it's something you got to realize if you're a person that's got tendencies towards that. And definitely Assassin's Creed was one of the games that made me realize that, like, particularly Assassin's Creed 2, which has a huge amount of side stuff, some of which I really enjoyed, some of which I couldn't have cared less for. And I started off not being a completionist, because I'm not a super completionist, but I started off with that, with like, okay, I'm gonna try all this stuff and try and get as far as it on it as I can. And I finally said, like, yeah, I just gotta stop doing certain types of missions. Like, there's some of these types of missions I'm just never gonna like, so why am I trying to progress on them? And once I did that, I got a lot happier with that game, and then I've taken that approach with all of the other Assassin's Creed games since then I've played, and enjoyed them quite a bit.
Yeah. I think it's different for every person, but there's a lot of side quests that feel like filler, and I feel like, you know, it's filler when you don't even get anything out of it, when it's just like, hey, good job, here's, you know, the reward is just not worth the effort that you put into it. when it's, you end up getting like, you know, 50 extra experience points, which ultimately you need 10,000 to advance to the next level. It's like, those sorts of things are hurt the ego more than actually getting useful rewards. Like the Tomb Raider is a good example, because all the tombs, you end up getting like bow pieces and things that you can use to upgrade your weapons to actually enhance your playing experience quite a bit. Whereas World of Warcraft, where you get, you know, crappy, and not to pick on World of Warcraft, but when you collect the hides and then you get, you know, a little bit of experience, it's like, well, you know, that's not really. I think that people don't want to check a box just to check the box. I think that you have to put a carrot on the end of the stick, so to speak.
And like I said, MMOs have a hard time balancing that well, because you got to consider in the context of all the other people playing the game and the economy, and not unbalancing things. You can, in a single player game, you can reward people a lot more, because them getting awesome fast isn't gonna wreck the experience in any way. So it's a trade-off that's a lot easier to manage with a single player experience than a multiplayer experience.
Yeah, totally agree.
How about we do a sponsor?
Sure.
All right.
This episode is brought to you by our close personal friends at Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and enter promo code Marco.
Did you just take ATP's ad read and just do it as is without even discussing it with Squarespace?
I figured they would get sued
for that.
You know, actually, that's a good point. I should probably edit that out. I think that's probably a liability.
It'll be fine, I'm sure.
It'll be fine. I think that's just what you do when you're on a podcast.
That's what I've heard.
I was listening to an episode of This American Life, which I'd heard a lot about, but had never actually listened to before. And it was sponsored by Squarespace as well. Like, I assumed that Squarespace was like a like geek podcast sort of thing, but maybe they're just supporting the entire podcast industry. No,
I think they just have a deal where you just, if you read their ad, they'll just send you, they detect that and they send you a check, or at least that's what I'm counting on.
Nice.
So
here's a question. So we've talked a lot about the longer end of the games. Are there other shorter games that are, you know, shorter even than the length of Portal or Journey that you guys have found to be as good?
Well, I would say one of the best games narratively that's very short recently is Flappy Bird.
I did all the side quests in Flappy Bird.
Yeah, it's like 4 to 6 seconds long. One of the most successful games of the year. And, you know, it maybe wasn't perfect, but it maybe demonstrates that people don't need a 40-hour grind fest.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that it had actually come out in May of 2013.
I learned that just in like since it was pulled.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it seemed to actually grow pretty organically, and it wasn't until it got a couple of big people or well-known people using it before it actually just took off suddenly. But it's a wonderful game. I mean. Or was a wonderful game, I guess. Did you see that?
I don't know. It seemed like a pretty terrible game to me.
I mean, it had that aspect of grindiness where there's certain people who are wired that they're going to want to keep playing it, but maybe also wired that they're going to feel regretful. I don't know. I'm not sure if it's game developers' job to. I mean, apparently the guy who made it felt guilty that people were getting addicted to it, and mm-hmm. part of why he pulled it was because he felt that it was a hurting people's lives. I don't know how much it is game developers' responsibility to build a game that
doesn't hurt people's lives. It was the exact opposite approach of Zynga, I think, is what he was going for.
It was nice to see that in the game industry, someone who at least seemed to care about the consequences of the game. But I think that's always going to be a problem with any game that doesn't end, right? If we build games or play games that have a storyline like The Last of Us or Journey or whatever that has a clear ending, and yeah, you can play it again, but there's a sense of satisfaction, like, okay, this is successful, I've gotten through it, it's worked, as opposed to games where it's never going to end, it's just a continual treadmill, either in the extreme Zynga or Dungeon Keeper sort of in-app purchase thing, or even just the harmless one where you die over and over again and you just try to get the highest score. there's a very different sense of completion and satisfaction where you're going to look back on it. That most people don't tend to look back 10 or 20 years on the games that they burned a lot of time in, but never really got any satisfaction from.
Yeah, it's true.
Versus the games where they played it and they were like, man, that ending was great.
Yeah, I would cite Tetris as the counterexample to that, because that's definitely in that like grindy, repetitive, frustrating gameplay school. And it's definitely a game that I remember playing from when it first came out. So
yeah, that's true.
But do you think fondly? You're like, man, I miss those days when I played Tetris excessively. Or do you think more fondly on the experiences you had that had a conclusion?
I definitely think more fondly on the experiences I had that had a conclusion. Like, I think Tetris is unusual in that respect, that it's a really high quality game from a gameplay tuning standpoint. Like, it's got a really nice mix of, you know, how the difficulty ramps as you're playing a particular game and how you sort of feel responsible for making the mistakes that make things harder and stuff like that, make it way better tuned than something like Flappy Bird, where it just, like, to me, I flapped through that first set of pipes and hit the second one. I'm like, this is ridiculous. Like, why would I bother learning this skill? Whereas Tetris sneaks up on you a lot slower.
Yeah.
And
I like the concept of Tetris as a slower paced Flappy Bird.
That's almost exactly what it is.
I think it's interesting, though. I think there is a difference. I think that Tetris was more like a cultural phenomenon, whereas if you look at another game that had one of the first games that I played that had a huge impact on me emotionally almost is probably Final Fantasy VII.
Oh yeah,
on PlayStation 1. And like, I don't know, spoiler alert, but you know, when Ares dies,
now I don't have to play it.
I know, but when I was playing that game and that happened to me, it was so painful, right? I think I remember crying being a kid and just like, you know, in your parents' basement playing this PlayStation game. And it's, and you can kind of, when you talk to other people about that sort of event, it's definitely this shared experience that you had versus I can't relate any of my Tetris games to any of my friends.
When you tell people about crying at that death, people are either like, oh my God, I know, it was terrible.
You start crying with them and hug.
Yeah. Or they're like, seriously, you cried at a video game where people had like 8 polygons per character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally. And that's actually when I talk about games that have a satisfying experience when you look back on them because of the, you know, emotional moments or completion in them, I'm not actually saying Final Fantasies, but that's what I think of because that was my experience as well.
Totally.
Yeah, I never got into Final Fantasy particularly. I'm not a JRPG person. I didn't have like the right mix of consoles for them. But for me, the game that fills that same niche is probably Grim Fandango.
Oh, I remember that.
Which is a like LucasArts adventure game from the sort of heyday of the LucasArts adventures that had, it had a lot of emotional heft to it. Like not quite at the Final Fantasy VII level, but definitely like the end of that, you know, you feel like you've been on a real journey and like are kind of choked up by sort of the, not even like the end of characters. It's not someone dying in that case. It's more just like a saying goodbye to certain characters that have been on the journey with you and, you know, how your character moves on at the end of it. And like, That's the game that I think of as like the first game that I feel like really kind of got to me emotionally, as opposed to just being like, oh yeah, this is a fun game where I'm playing through this story. Even for story driven games, like even setting aside stuff like Tetris that's just arcadey. Like, I'd certainly played through RPGs before that, like the, you know, the classic like AD&D gold box games and stuff like that, which had stories, but they weren't stories that affected you. There were stories that were, you know, excuses to drive the gameplay on.
Right.
I don't know if it's I've gotten mushy in my old age or the fact that this current generation of consoles has really upped the experience as far as what you deliver in the package of a game. I think it's the latter. But the number of games that I've teared up at in this console generation, like in the last 5 years, is way more than every previous game put together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like games like The Last of Us and Bioshock Infinite Or even Portal, like, I played Portal and Portal 2 both, actually, and the end of it, the song, the Jonathan Coulton song that has this, like, cheery, slightly sad, and your nemesis is singing you a song. Like, I tear up at that, where it's not just, like, it's not really sad, but it's sort of, it's over, and it feels very satisfying, and it feels, as you're saying goodbye, and I don't know.
No, absolutely.
No, I would say definitely we've hit a bit of a crossover point with this generation of games, where it's a lot easier to get people emotionally invested in games because you've got more tools available than you did the previous times. And I mean, some of the memorable moments I don't think do depend on having particular cinematic tools or technology available. Like, some of them are just good writing. The companion cube in Portal is like the prime example of that, of like, here's this character that has no distinguishing characteristics whatsoever, is not even animate. And like, I think I'm probably not alone. And like, I stood by the incinerator chute for a good, like, 2 or 3 minutes before I tossed the cube in. Cause I'm like, well, I guess I have to, I don't want to, but I guess I have to.
Yeah. And then GLaDOS is like, oh, you were one of the fastest to put the cube in the incinerator.
Just make you feel horrible, yeah. I think it's interesting, though, that they're able, that we are reaching a point now where we get games like Journey, which are shorter, yet still have that same sort of emotional impact. Like, I thought Journey was, the ending was incredible for me, and it just seemed like, hopefully we're going to get more and more of those. I mean, it seems pretty good.
So are we, though? Like, is are the economics of games like that, Journey, we all who care about video games obviously see Journey and Bioshock Infinite and Last of Us as, you know, these amazing games that obviously are a higher artistic accomplishment than most of the games in previous generations. But is the same thing being seen on the publisher side, or is that just some experiment that some guy did and now please go back and make another first-person shooter?
Well, something like Journey, I think, like, it's been able to carve out something there in the downloadable game market for the consoles, that because that's something that didn't really exist before, that there wasn't a really mass-market distribution platform that you could have those technical tools to up the quality. You know, you can have good, like, visual quality so that it doesn't look like it's a bunch of flappy polygons that you're trying to watch a moat. In the case of Journey, I think a huge part of what made it emotionally impactful was how good the environment looked, right? Like, Journey didn't spend a lot of its technical budget on the character and on the things that you usually think of as being important to making identify, but what they did is they created this really unique world that kind of sucked you in by how interesting it was. And then, you know, while you're sucked in, they can make you relate to this character who doesn't really have a lot of personality. And that's the same sort of thing as like the companion cube in Portal, right? It's a character that you start to care about because you'd bought into the world. And so you've got the tools available, you know, you've got powerful hardware. You've got a distribution mechanism that lets them sell the game for like 10 or 15 bucks and people can find it. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, like, there wasn't really as a way to do that. Like, there wasn't a way to get games other than figure out like where to download them from yourself. And there were practical limits on how big they could be because, you know, broadband internet was just becoming a thing. And now it's like, all right, everyone's got these consoles. All these consoles are online. You give them your credit card once, you can go to the store, you can plunk down your 10 bucks. So if someone hears about Journey and is like, yeah, that's something that sounds interesting to me, they can have it and be playing it in 10 minutes. And that makes those kinds of experiences a lot more accessible, I think, which is great. And even on the PC side, you've got Steam. Like, Steam is sort of the equivalent to that, right? It started a little earlier on the PCs than it did on the consoles, but it's also provided this great platform where games that couldn't have been distributed in any way before at least can be now, and all they have to do is get the get people to buy in, get the emotional mind share from people to go looking for them.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick, you mentioned earlier Hearthstone is something that you've been taking a look at. How does that play into game length? It's a sort of a multiple short cycle type of game.
Yeah. So have either of you haven't played it, Nigel? Have you got on the beta of Hearthstone yet?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So did you guys ever play Magic the Gathering growing up?
Yes.
Tiny little bit. I was never into it, but I knew some people that were into it, so I played some games of it.
Okay. Well, Hearthstone is essentially Blizzard's take on Magic the Gathering as a card game, but as a computer game, and apparently they're going to do a iPad version of it as well. But it's the idea of it is it's brilliant. It's different enough from Magic that it is very much its own game, but it's clearly rooted in that sort of like summon minions and have them do battle and cast spells, and they're all the cards have mana values, and it's very, very similar. But it's interesting because it's very fast paced. In that you only have 30 cards per deck, and once you run out of cards to play, you just start taking one damage every turn until you're dead. And that actually rarely happens. Most games don't even get to that point. So it's a much faster paced game. I've been playing it a lot with a coworker, and most games tend to be between 10 to 20 minutes. But it's interesting because you get to build your deck, and that's kind of part of it, is building your own decks and organizing your cards and collecting them. You can buy cards either through using real money or using points that you can earn by doing quests. And the quests are just simple things like play 3 games, you know, win 5 in a row, play 3 games with a mage, that sort of thing. And so you end up getting you can spend a lot of time in the game trying to optimize different decks and trying to do different things, or you can spend very little time in the game by just playing what Blizzard calls the casual decks, which are pre-made decks that they just give you, and you will only play against other people who are also using those pre-made decks. So if you have no interest in kind of collecting cards and building your own decks, you can still play and enjoy the game a lot using the pre-made stuff. And so it's interesting in that there's a very flexible amount of time you can spend in the game, and it has infinite replayability because every game is different. And yeah, I've been enjoying it immensely. I think it's really, really fun, and it'll be really fun to play on the iPad once that's out. But also just the heads up multiplayer one-on-one style of gameplay is fantastic. So if you guys should check it out, it's pretty cool.
There's definitely something appealing to, like I call us grown-ups, as people who, you know, have jobs and maybe have more budget than we have for games than we do time budget to play them, for these little games that you can pick how many times you want to play them, rather than sitting down and playing like a 6 to 14 hour game of Axis and Allies or something like that, where it just never ends. And these things where you're like, oh, well, I'll sit down and play a few rounds, and then when I'm done, I'll be done. As even something like the sports games, like a game of any professional sport, like hockey or what have you, takes at least, like, in real time, like a couple hours.
Right.
And for, you know, it's hard to get in a couple, 2 or 3 games of that.
Though almost all sports games do speed the clock up pretty substantially. Like, it doesn't take you 60 minutes of play time to play a game of hockey, like, you know, like NHL or whatever I can't actually remember what the full title is, but whatever the like EA NHL game is. I don't know exactly what the multiplier they use is, but it's got to be at least double speed for.
Yeah, but you can't play a 10-minute game and then rematch a couple times.
I do think that Hearthstone falls on the edge of being much more like an iPhone game, where it's meant to be played kind of almost on a commute or in a short period of time. There is no version of it where you can have 60 card decks and there is no timeout to the game, and there's no way to kind of make it into more of an epic kind of game. So it's definitely seems to be it wants to hit that target of, yes, you can play it on your commute. Yes, you can play it if you only have 10 to 20 minutes, which seems to be more like what most iOS games to me are like. So it does feel a little bit different in that regard.
I would say most iOS games actually target even shorter than that. Like, I consider the games that have the like 10 to 20 minute play sessions to actually be, they're kind of my favorite iOS games, because I do like doing, you know, I've got a fairly long commute, and so if I'm going to play a game on it, I want something that's going to take a good chunk of it rather than you know, what I'll usually do if I don't have anything that I'm sort of playing right now, or if I'm going to be reading my RSS feeds for part of it or whatever, is I'll just play one of my go-to, like, 2 to 3 minute per play kind of games. But I like those 10 to 20 minute games, and there aren't actually a lot of them, even on iOS. Like, a lot of them are more of the Flappy Bird, like, play for, you know, 10 to 30 seconds most games, and then you got to start over, so I think there's definitely, like, tiers there of where the games fit, even on iOS.
Yeah.
Well, there's a maximum game length on something like iOS, where any longer than 20 minutes, say, for most people, why are you even playing it on your iPad or your phone? Why are you not just playing it on your Mac or playing it on a console, right? Like, obviously consoles, unfortunately, take like 5 minutes to actually load up and agree that you have to press start to continue and agree that, yes, the game does save occasionally at points, certain points, don't turn off your system.
Not anymore, though. That's the best part. I don't know.
Do you have one in the new?
I have a PS4, and it's wonderful in that it boots up very quickly, and it launches games reasonably fast.
Does it have a screen just to warn you that sometimes the game saves, so watch out?
Yeah. I think that's a requirement.
They haven't figured that one
to be
out yet.
To be sold in the PS4 box, you still need to have that. I don't know. No, but it's at least that is small and unnoticeable. And for the PS4 has a standby mode, which it will download updates automatically and do a bunch of other things. They've gotten better at understanding that. For the PS3, it was terrible anyway, in terms of you'd turn the system on, it would have to download an update, that would take 5 minutes, then it would have to install it, that would take 10 minutes, then you'd open the game, then the game would have to update, and then it was
and then
just
install.
Yeah, and then you had to go to bed because it's 1 a.m. But no, they've gotten a lot better at recognizing, and I don't have an Xbox One, so I can't speak for that, but the experience on the PlayStation 4 has been much better, for sure.
And all those things, like updating faster and allowing you to get into the game faster, lowers the, you know, price of entry as far as time, where a game that has shorter play sessions can be more viable.
Exactly.
On the console. Whereas previously, it's like, why even bother? If you're not going to sit down for an hour, don't even bother turning it on. Because, I mean, like, think of PlayStation 1, where it would take literally 10 minutes just to load the level.
Yeah.
For your first play session or whatever.
Yep.
That's changing a lot.
The one thing that the PlayStation does, that is, I think, really dickish, is that it will only download updates automatically in standby mode if you are a member of the PlayStation Plus network thing, mm-hmm. the thing that you have to pay for.
Are you kidding me?
Which is just, like, it's so clear. Like, there's no reason for that other than to sell more memberships. So it's just like, oh, really? I mean, I'm going to buy one anyway because I want to play games online, but still, really, really?
But now you don't want to.
Yeah, now I'm just angry. Like, everyone should have this. Come on, it's easy. It's better. It's better for everyone.
Microsoft, they do the downloads automatically, but doesn't Microsoft Xbox have a thing where the updates come on the disc?
Yeah, at least they did within the 360 era. I don't know about the Xbox One, but yeah, 360 and Wii both... all of the, like, whatever system update was needed to play the game was always on the disc. So I don't even actually have a Xbox Live subscription for my 360 because I'm not a big online multiplayer gamer. So I think I'm actually probably going to get one now, and I'm going to, like, try and, before I pick up my next gen console, burn through, like, the couple of pieces of DLC that I never got around to getting from this generation, but I'll get my Xbox Live subscription for like 3 months and then download all the DLC and then cancel it and get a PS4. But yeah, you don't need any network connection at all. Like, my Xbox is not even plugged in to the network. Every time I get a game with a new disc on, it just says, yep, we've got you do a system update, and it does a system update.
So one last thing, when we're thinking about game length and games where you really put the time in to get satisfying ending, have either of you heard of Desert Bus?
Mm-hmm. I have heard of it through the whole Penny Arcade Desert Bus for charity gaming thing.
So you've heard of it. Have either of you seen or played Desert Bus?
No,
I haven't played it.
So for anyone who's not heard of it, Desert Bus is one of the games that makes up Penn and Teller Smoke and Mirrors, which I believe was a Sega CD game. and this is a game where you drive across the desert in a bus. It takes 8 hours to complete. You can't pause the game. And you're just driving down a straight featureless road through the desert. And it seems like you would just be able to leave the controller there and it would just go. But actually, the bus just very slightly tilts to the left. So you need to actually occasionally correct in order for it to stay on the road. But at 8 hours, it's actually still shorter than many of the at the time, maybe it was a long game. But now it's actually a lot shorter than a lot of the things that they put us through now to grind through and collect all the pages of paper before we finish. So
most of the things now, though, have a fair bit more gameplay variety than Desert Bus does, though.
So you're telling me that it's like someone took Microsoft Flight Simulator and was like, how can we make this more boring?
It's exactly like that, but much, much, much more boring.
I'll check it out.
So I think that's our check this out game for the week.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
All right. I think let's button it up.
All right.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Check out the show notes at upup.fm and see you next week. Have you seen the Dungeon Keeper discussion, Patrick?
I have only I'm on the periphery of it. I have heard about all the angriness, but I haven't actually investigated what the controversy is.
So basically, Dungeon Keeper was this popular series, and it was a fairly, like in the vein of Civilization and SimCity, where the game you spend a lot of time, you sit there and you build stuff. And of course, nowadays, when you build stuff, you don't just actually build it. You tell something to start building, and then it tells you how many hours or days it will take.
Right. To and you can building. You can purchase the, obviously,
of course,
the completion.
And all these things are complained about, like, oh, this Dungeon Keeper is such ridiculous how many purchases it forces you to do in order to actually play the game. I expected it to be ridiculous, but just to see, I downloaded the game entirely to see how ridiculous it was. And I didn't realize from their descriptions that every single step, like maybe there's 20 or 30 steps in the tutorial. Once you get to the third or fourth step, every single time, one of the steps is now pay in-app purchase currency, which is these gems, in order to complete this step and then continue.
So just to get through the tutorial, you have to pay money.
Well, they give you enough of this currency in order to do it up front, but there isn't really any other way once the tutorial is over to get any more other than paying. And I looked, like, in order to sort of, as an experiment, I didn't actually use the currency that it told me to in the tutorial. I was just like, they're like, all right, build this thing. I'm like, okay. So I build it. It's like, it's going to take 20 minutes to build. So here's some gems, spend them to make it build. And instead I just walked away and it came back 20 minutes later and then I kept the gems. So I hoarded them the whole tutorial and it took a couple of hours to get through the tutorial. And then when it was done, it's like the first thing I wanted to do is like, okay, I'll purchase another imp to like help me build stuff. And it was like, oh, you need twice as many gems as you have. And there's no other way to get gems other than to buy them. So even though I hoarded them all and I spent hours doing the tutorial just to hoard them, I still didn't have enough gems to do the first thing I wanted to do.
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like scummy in that purchase. There was a really good article not too long ago that was all, it was called something monetization techniques, and it basically just went through all the different ways, all the more or less academic terms and that these games use in order to extract money from people. And it was really, really interesting because the economics of it, like they have all this hard research done on how if you calculating costs of things in dollars is easy for humans to do, obviously, because we do it all the time and it's fine. But as soon as you convert that into diamonds or gems, it becomes more difficult. So if you have like $5 is equal to 3,000 gems, then it's like, okay, then it gets more difficult in your brain to rationalize spending 3,000 gems. But if you add an additional layer of complexity on top of that, so it's like, okay, five fairies is equal to 3,000 gems, which is equal to $30. It's like people will be like, oh yeah, five fairies, sure, whatever, even though it's $30. So if you, the more levels of indirection you add in between the currency, like the hard currency and the cost of what it is that you're buying, the more people become like the less they care. And it's really evil and weird, but it's how the industry works.
Yeah, people are like, yeah, whatever, gems. Yeah, sure, I'll spend 100, I guess. It's very much then an emotional decision rather than irrational.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, if you can find that article, we'll...
Oh, yeah.
Whereas I'm like the exact opposite. Even without spending any real money, I've got like 100-some thousand coins in Plants vs. Zombies 2. And I'll be like, oh, do I really want to spend 1,000 coins to like... bail myself out of this game that I've invested the last 15 minutes in that I'm almost losing? And even though it's like a tiny fraction of my store, I'm like, no, I'll just try it again and be smarter next time.
I'm always the one who ends the game with like 40 life potions and 28 super.
You get all the hearts in Zelda, right?
Yeah, and then I don't have used any potions that I... Just in case, it's really hard eventually at the end.
I sent you that link in the chat.
Excellent.
It's a fun read. It's like, because it's one of those things where you're like, oh, gross. Because you know that it's been done to you before and you didn't realize it.
I like that story that circulated a year or two ago about how the Zynga office was more like Wall Street than Silicon Valley, where everyone was just doing spreadsheets calculating how they could optimize money out of people's pockets.
Oh god.
Like, if we make it so your cow in Farmville is going to die of dysentery at a certain time of night, but you know, maybe if you have a certain amount of money in the bank, then you're going to be more likely to spend more to save it, then we're going to make more money. So they would optimize all the things.
I'll tell a story. I don't know if it can be put in the show or not, but I'll tell a story anyway, which is that I knew one of the early people at Zynga, through a friend of a friend, one of the really, really early employees at Zynga. She was an artist, and she would work on things like, she was an illustrator, she'd work on things like Farmville, and it was crazy because she would come home after work and be like, oh, how's your day? She's like, oh, it was pretty cool. I mean, I just drew a hat, and then they made it into the game, and yeah, I don't know, made like 50 grand a day. And I was like, what? It's like, she would, the thing that she would just draw little assets that you could buy to dress up your Farmville character and things like that. And then she would be like, oh, cool, that made, you know, $500,000, whatever. Like,
no problem.
It was just, it was like one of the funny things she did is another one of our friends had this like yellow trucker hat that he would wear all the time. And so she drew that and put it in the game and like named it like Tom's hat or whatever it was. And yeah, it was one of the top sellers and it made them just ridiculous amounts of money.
Tom's hat made like $1,000,000. And Tom's like, hey,
for just a crazy little digital asset so you could dress up your guy. Pretty crazy.
And I'm not entirely sure that it mattered. I mean, I'm sure her art was great, but it was more probably whatever they put up there.
Yeah.
That you have enough people playing, but they're spending enough time, they're like, well, what's a dollar to put a thing on my cow's head when I've already spent $500 or 500 hours
totally,
on this thing?
Totally. It was just the scale that they work at and the willingness to spend money was just insane.
I'm curious what the culture is like there. I mean, I guess in the early days, it was sort of like, hey, whatever, because we're making infinite money. And now there's sort of round after round of layoffs and they're focusing down. Apparently, word on the street is that they're going to actually try to make games that are fun.
What?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not. This is uncorroborated, but
they might have just gone too far down the dark path. Like they might not have, you know, that. They don't have the people anymore, that anyone who cared about making fun games has already gotten like fed up and left. And the metrics that they're using to track things are not ever going to catch fun. And I don't know, I'd be really skeptical of them making a transition to making good games. That would be like, you know, getting like the crew that films Here Comes Honey Boo Boo to like make the next Citizen Kane. Like, I just don't, I don't see it happening.
It's not in their, it's not in their DNA.
It's not,
I think,
in their DNA.
Yeah.
So you're saying they're beleaguered.
Definitely.
Yeah, I'm sure though, in that like 6 to 18 months of the golden age of Zynga, though, is an interesting place to be.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For just that brief flash in time.
A flash in the pan, yeah.
Before Flappy Bird and Rovio and whatever.
What's your Flappy Bird high score, Alan?
Oh, man, I spent some decent time. I think I got up to 7.
Cool. I got to 17. I was pretty happy with it. Yeah. I found the trick. There is a trick to it.
Oh, of course.
Which is that you got to aim so that your guy hits the front bottom pipe and then jump right before he does.
Okay.
And that as long as if you aim for that as like the focal point of where he should be going every time, it's way easier. That's how I'm routinely able to get scores between like 5 and 15 that way.
Nice.
But getting above 17 has been really hard. I'm not sure if it actually gets harder as you go, or if it just is always really hard. It's hard to tell.
Have you seen the same guy has a Flappy Bird? So there's a million Flappy Bird clones from other people, but he has a Flappy Bird clone of his own from like, I guess, because this whole thing is like a year old, but now everyone's, it's called like Flappy Man or something. It's like a crappy superhero sucks at flying.
Is it still in the store?
I think so. And it's exactly like, it's the same code as Flappy Bird, obviously. It's just the superhero flies poorly and then hits things and dies repeatedly. But it's also making lots of money, and that's like got no press at all, even though it's like the same guy.
Flappy Superhero is by Miracle Studios. It looks like a ripoff. I think that probably came out recently.
I don't even have Flappy Bird on my phone. I played 3 games of it on Alan's phone. The first 2 times I crashed into the first pipe. The 3rd time I made it through the first pipe and crashed into the second pipe. And I said, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. I am never playing it again. And I have not.
Meanwhile, multiple people at Steam Clock are posting in HipChat like, oh, look, I got like 21. And I'm like, hey, cool. And that's just like, what are you guys doing?
What's wrong with you people?
Do you guys know Terry Cavanaugh? The
indie, name sounds familiar.
He's an indie game maker. He made VVVVV and Super Hexagon.
Super Hexagon is also awesome. That kind of thing where you die in like 8 seconds and somehow feel good.
So he made a Flappy Bird clone and released it today online. It's just a little flash game, but it's called Maverick Bird. And it's actually awesome because it adds one extra control, which is dive. So in addition to flapping, you can dive. And the style of it is all very Super Hexagon. Like, it's just like loud, fast techno music and backgrounds that change and are confusing with the pipes. And it's actually really cool.
I can certainly imagine a game like Flappy Bird. I don't know that I would like, but that it at least wouldn't like disgust me. But the thing about Flappy Bird is it just struck me as like really badly tuned, right? Like there was no even attempt at there being like a difficulty curve or having another axis of control that you can, you know, that you can use to like get yourself out of tough situations or something like that. Like it really is just kind of the same thing over and over again, starting from the very first second of the game. And that thing just really isn't much fun to me.
Is it badly tuned though? Like, I think you have to give it that it's tuned in a way that's entertaining to a lot of people because it's obviously really popular with the exact gameplay that it has. The thing that bothers me, like, it's not even Retina. Like, it's blurry on an iPhone 4.
Really?
Which, yes, it is. I didn't even notice.
Hold on.
As soon as I loaded it up, I was like, oh, really? Seriously? This has just got to be some scam or something. But it's not even Retina. And when you die, there's no particular, like, imagine the exact same tuning, which is obviously what people are enjoying. But when the bird hits the pipe, there's like an explosion or something, or like, I don't know. Like, and also people say, oh, well, part of the fun is that the game starts immediately. You just have to click OK and then play. But every single time you have to click OK and then play, even though you're 99.9% of the time going to play again. Like, why doesn't it just immediately start?
Yeah.
To me, it's like, a game that is tuned, obviously, in a way that really hits people's imagination, that there's so many things that you could, if you had the exact code base and then like 1 to 2 more weeks to polish it, it could be twice as good. Oh, and yeah, then probably would shut down all productivity on Earth.
I just got a new high score.
while we were playing.
Yeah. Sorry. I was listening. I was also just playing at the same time. I got a 23. It's pretty good.
That's good. We'll put that in the show.
I also got a sweet claim your free Zodiac horoscope.
Oh, yeah, that's great. How many times have you accidentally clicked on the ads?
The ads are just, never actually. They're just wonderful, though.
It's the ad-supported games are just frustrating to like click through and play. I picked up one of these game controllers the other day. You know, the ones that like bolt onto the side of your
iPhone. Oh yeah, how was iPhone. That?
It's pretty good. The one that I got, the MOGO Power Ace, like you have the choice between like the Logitech one and this MOGO one, and I'm like, well, of course the Logitech one's going to be better, except the Logitech one is like just a D-pad and buttons. Like, it doesn't even have any analog sticks. So I'm like, all right, well, I got to get this MOGO thing. The build quality is not great, but the games that support it, like, it's just like, yeah, you've got, like, you basically bolt this thing onto your iPhone and turn it into like a PSP, essentially. And the games that support it are like totally playable and everything. But I was like, okay, well, I got to try out some games that have this once I got it. And I had found this list of like, here's all the games that support the MFI controller online. And one of them is like Pac-Man. I'm like, all right, yeah, Pac-Man. I think I even might've downloaded that previously. And I go and look and I'm like, yeah, there's the Pac-Man. It's just like the free version. Like, there's also a paid version, but I think there was only the free version at the time that I got, or something like that. And basically it's just like every time you die, at least, maybe even if you finish the map successfully, you just get like a full screen ad for another game with a cancel button that is the smallest hit target that I've ever seen in my entire life. And is like right next to the enormous hit target for opening the app store. And I probably like 30% of the time I accidentally open the app store from the ad rather than clicking on the no, I don't care about this game button to continue. And it's one of those things of like, I kind of want to just buy, like, I like Pac-Man, you know, I wouldn't mind having a good Pac-Man game. It's a good demo game for the controller, but I kind of don't even want to give them my $2 now because the free version was so irritating.
Speaking of weird ads, have you guys seen this thing where some sketchy websites, there's one blog in particular that I read, which is somewhat sketchy because it's just really poorly written, but it's well sourced. It's called SonyAlphaRumors.com, and it's a rumor site for Sony cameras, which I know is really deeply nerdy. However, because it's so sketchy, it has ads just all over the place. But if you go to it on your phone, it will just, every once in a while, like maybe 1 in 4 visits, it will just open a link to an App Store app. Like it'll just go straight from Safari into the App Store to an app page. So there's no prompt. There's no like, hey, would you like to check this thing out? It just sends you there. Yeah, which I think is a very aggressive and kind of funny, honestly, in terms of the like sketchy advertising. Like, yeah, just hijack what I'm doing right now to show me an app I can download.
Have you ever accidentally clicked on the little Yahoo icon in the corner of the Apple Weather app?
No.
So the little corner. It used to be that the bottom left corner was like the settings for the weather app, but now it's the Yahoo icon. And so I accidentally hit it whenever I want to change to get the weather in like whatever local city I am in. And when you do that, you get a Yahoo page that immediately prompts you with a okay or cancel dialogue.
Oh, do you want to change your search engine?
Do you want to change your search engine to Yahoo?
Yeah.
And before I read that, every single time, like maybe 5 times now, I just immediately see the dialogue and I click OK because I want to go back to the weather. And then I change my search to Yahoo. And then I'm immediately like, damn it. And I have to go back and change it again.
That's pretty ridiculous.
And that's, I don't really put that above Yahoo. It's like, yeah, OK, Yahoo, be in Yahoo. But the fact that that's built into the operating system, that there's a button that will immediately, effectively, there's a button in iOS 7 that will prompt you to unexpectedly change your search engine to Yahoo.
That's
and,
funny.
I just think that's great.
Did you know that in the weather you can tap the temperature?
Oh, I didn't.
iOS 7, cool. Discoverability!
Feels like 2 degrees.
That's
Celsius.
Yeah, that's a useful feature there.
Yeah, too bad it's hidden. Most people don't know about it.
That's one of those things that someone was like, hey, look, we have this little thing, and they wanted to make some UI for it. And then someone's like, okay, well, we'll agree to it only if there's no UI for
it. Yeah.
And it's like, well, they're not going to remove the code at that point.
Yeah.
That is good to know, though. But now, you know, the three of us and our listeners coast to coast know about that feature.
Yes. Awesome.
Excellent. Cool. Well, thanks for joining us, Patrick.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And yeah, we'll send you a cut of
all the Squarespace money.
Yeah, it'll be
sweet.
I figure 20% is fair.
Okay.
I figure Squarespace sends out checks in the sort of 1 to 200K range.
Well, I would negotiate more, but I believe the show is already done. So I think my options are limited.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you're a little bit of a bind, but I think it'll be good.
Okay, cool.